the same page. And that's okay. Meeting people where they are and helping them with the burdens they carry today seems a more lucrative act of kindness and compassion. Your words carry power, not only for others, but first and foremost, for yourself. What you speak over your life is what your life will become. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they are not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, find your voice and speak life and love into others as well as over your own life. The power imbalance shifts when you expose the discrepancies while gaining knowledge about your own thoughts and opinions. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
KBOO.
KPFA in Berkeley, California. It's the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we are proud to present an encore broadcast of our special Indigenous Peoples Day program with host and producer Sarah Blanco. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
Thank you for tuning into Flashpoints. Sarah Blanco here, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. First, we'll listen to some sounds from the Indigenous Peoples Day gathering on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco.
Well, we're going to go now back to the drum here. The All Nations drum is gathered, and a welcome song to everyone.
Respectful greetings to you, my relatives, on this beautiful morning. You know, last night and still today, there was a full moon. Mala Mecha was here in all of her power to take care of the women, to take care of the life givers of all the nations, to take care of the water. They called it a very special full moon, a blood moon. So let's our blood connect with Mala Mecha this morning as she sets behind the clouds and as we welcome Achaita'a, our sacred Father the Son to bless us today.
They're going to sing the original Longest Walk song from 1978. The Longest Walk started here on Alcatraz Island and went all the way across the country to Washington, D.C. They say that Alcatraz is the spark that lit the flame of Indigenous resistance. And so here we are 52 years later, 53 years later, still here today, still here holding this space at this time and holding down those frontline struggles, as so many of our relatives have mentioned. So Michael Ballinger, who has been here for the past 40 years.
Oh, God.
Oh, for him, the Wapapa family.
I got it.
All of our drummers that are here today are longtime, you know, warriors here that have helped us with all of these struggles. And so thank them for being here. Shake their hand, and you'll see them at Yerba Buena also. But here's the Longest Walk honor song, and we ask for those veterans to come out.
You just listened to Sounds from Alcatraz, recorded live on Indigenous Peoples Day. I had a chance to speak to the Foreign Minister for the Hawaiian Kingdom. We are speaking to Leon Kalahau Siu. Welcome to Flashpoints, Leon.
Mahalo. It's good to be here.
As part of reflecting upon Indigenous Peoples Day, please start us off with a brief introduction of yourself and also a history of the Hawaiian Kingdom.
Oh, okay. My name is Leon Kalahau Siu. I'm the Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Hawaiian Kingdom. And many of you are unfamiliar with that term, Hawaiian Kingdom, because most people don't realize the Hawaiian Kingdom exists. Most people think about Hawaii as a state of the United States, but it actually is not. It actually was never legally made a state of the United States. Therefore, we still contend that Hawaii is still a sovereign nation like it was in the 19th century, recognized by all the nations of the world, and with treaties and with diplomatic legations all over the world, and in full discourse with the rest of the world having to do with international matters. So the Hawaiian Kingdom was rudely interrupted in 1893 when the United States landed troops in Hawaii, in Honolulu, to support a coup d'etat, a regime change by a group of disgruntled sugar planters who wanted to take over the Hawaiian Islands so they could sell their sugar at a better price in the United States. The idea was to overthrow the kingdom, annex Hawaii to the United States, and then get a better price for their sugar. And the United States, on the other hand, felt, well, we sure would like to annex Hawaii because it has a great port there. A naval base could be built at this place called Pearl Harbor. And we could then expand our manifest destiny to the Western Pacific, to Asia. And so both sides colluded in 1893. The U.S. landed troops and the insurgents took over the government. The Queen stepped aside temporarily because knowing that this was an international violation of the sovereignty of our nation, she then appealed to the United States to return the kingdom. Soon after that happened, the Hawaiian Kingdom her appeals were heard by the new incoming president, President Cleveland, who agreed that the United States had acted improperly, in fact, had committed an act of war against a friendly nation. And so he instructed Congress that the Hawaiian Islands should be returned. But Congress did not take heed, and they kind of went along and stalled. And 4 years later, after President Cleveland had failed to become reelected, they had a new president, McKinley, who was very gung-ho on the idea of manifest destiny and the expansion of the U.S. Power into the Pacific. So he pushed for a treaty of annexation, which, by the way, failed to pass Congress twice. So failing a treaty, the U.S. resorted to a domestic resolution saying we're now annexing the Hawaiian Islands. And then they did a great celebration in Honolulu and pretended as if the Hawaiian Islands were annexed to the United States. And then they took over the rule of over the Hawaiian Kingdom. And from that time on, the United States simply carried on this this pretense of being there in Hawaii legally. And of course, many events happened that continued to merge Hawaiian interests with the United States. And the United States made a concerted effort to denationalize our people by basically not teaching us of our history, especially the school children, and replacing it with an American history. So three generations grew up thinking we were Americans. And until the 1970s, when things started to unravel for the United States, when we began to find out that the reason that we had no longer any control over our lands or our resources was because the United States had illegally taken over control of our islands. So since then, we have had a very active independence movement, that is the restoration of Hawaii independence. And most people don't know about it because it's been suppressed quite a bit by the United States. But we've made a tremendous number of amount of inroads over the last 40, 50 years. In fact, we really parallel the American Indian movement. We started around the same time, and we were buddies. We actually assisted each other at the UN in getting attention to indigenous issues and into the discussion about colonialism and all these types of concerns of Native peoples. So the Hawaiian Kingdom has been very active, or the Hawaiian nation has been very active in issues having to do with indigenous peoples as well as original nations. And so that's where we are right now. I was at the United Nations in Geneva for the demonstration that was held there last week, a little over a week ago, and also was there for the side event, the panel discussion that took place over Free Leonard Peltier. I participated in quite a number of them with our friend Tony Gonzalez at the UN in New York and in many other venues. But we really are seeing that the struggle of AIM and our struggle really go hand in hand, and that is the stand against not only colonial activity in the past, but what is still continuing, the continued colonial presence in our islands and here on Turtle Island as well. So we are walking side by side on this journey for independence, for freedom, and for our dignity.
Thank you for mentioning political prisoner and fighting for a political prisoner, Leonard Peltier. How does the Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Hawaiian Kingdom work with, if at all, within like the United States capacity? Maybe kind of draw us a picture of how that works. So we know there's a military there, we know there's a whole lot of environmental issues, but how are you able to work in that realm?
And my work is I am informing the international community about what's going on back in Hawaii. And using this kind of friendly relations, or building friendly relations, to ask them to assist us with bringing the United States under control with what they are doing right now. But at home, we've been very successful in moving the needle and into really being able to express ourselves, as well as to bring the United States and the state of Hawaii, the United States puppet government, to the table in many cases, and even having the United States admit that they had illegally taken control of the Hawaiian Islands. This occurred in 1993 by a formal apology by the Congress and President Clinton for their role in the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom 100 years earlier in 1893. So we actually have the United States admitting that they really don't belong there. But of course, the United States is pretending as if everything's fine now that they said they're sorry, and that they're continuing to maintain their presence in Hawaii as if nothing happened.
We've been speaking with Leon Kalahau Siu. Thank you so much for spending the time with us and for all the work that you have done across decades. You are the Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Hawaiian Kingdom. And I also noticed that you were nominated for the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize for your work in promoting independence for West Papua. You're a musician, composer, and just a lot of wonderful things that you've been doing, and we wish you the absolute best, and thank you for joining us on Flashpoints.
Well, mahalo to you. It's been my honor to speak with you and to your audience. And I want to say aloha to everybody. We really thank you for this opportunity to share our story.
Thank you very much. Bye for now.
Okay, aloha.
I'm Sarah Blanco for Flashpoints, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. You just heard an interview with the Foreign Minister for the Hawaiian Kingdom, Leon Kalahau Siu. Next, I talk with Laulani Teal about progress with protecting Mauna Kea.
Mahalo. My name is Laulani Teal, and I am the coordinator of Ho'opaipono Peace Project, which is an affiliate of Seventh Generation Fund for Indigenous Peoples. And we've been working to protect Mauna Kea alongside many others for a few decades now. My update about the Mauna, it remains solid. There is no construction happening right now, and that's been through the efforts of many, many people over time, all standing in their own ways to protect Mauna Kea. And right now we're going through multiple processes. Some are hard, such as the Department of Land and Natural Resources meeting coming up on October 14th, in which they're trying to take away the criteria for protecting sacred mountains and sacred places. Meanwhile, people do still stand on Mauna Kea. The Kupuna are still standing from wherever they are, and everyone is working together to protect in many different ways. The University of California students have been especially strong in addressing the UC Board of Regents, who they are asking to divest from TMT, and they will be having events coming up in the next few weeks and months. So please keep an eye out for those, and please support and stand with them if at all possible. Also, the indigenous peoples of the lands on which the UC and other campuses are on have been very strong in standing with us.
For those people who may not be aware, could you explain what the TMT is, but also what is already taken over the mountain, so to speak?
Well, the TMT is part of TMT International Observatory Corporation, which is a multinational corporation made up of partners from the University of California, the California Institute of Technology, Canada, Japan, China, and other partners. And those, all of those internationally are working together to try to build this 30-meter lens telescope, which basically would be housed in an 18-story high-rise, which is bigger than any building on the island of Hawaii, and on top of our sacred mountain on the northern plateau specifically, which is a traditional area for observing not only the heavens but also the rest of the archipelago, which can be seen to the north of that plateau. TMT has been stopped multiple times. The first time was during their first construction groundbreaking attempt in 2014. Then that was followed by many arrests in 2015. And in 2019, 38 elders were all arrested on the summit of Mauna Kea. And one kupuna that I kako'o or assist, Liko Martin, was one of those who was arrested. And since that time, they've been through so many court dates. Recently, the remaining kupuna who had not had to drop out of this were found not guilty, but years of their lives were taken up in that, just being wrapped up in court. So they are prepared very much to stand all over again if it comes down to it. The people here are very, very much prepared to stop the 30-meter telescope, as it is not pono, it is not right, it is not something that is in balance with nature, it is not the direction that science or humanity needs to head in this world in order for humanity to continue, in order for land and water to be protected, in order for us to have future generations at all, and that means all of us. So there are 13 telescopes that have already been built. Now, keep in mind that when we say a telescope, we're not just talking about one structure. A telescope, quote unquote, basically consists of potentially many structures, in some cases what they call an array of many pieces, many telescopes that are connected together with wires or by radio, and it, and then outlying buildings. So essentially, there is a lot of development on the top of Mauna Kea, which is our most sacred mountain and is the area with the most sacred waters beneath the surface as well. Mauna Kea is an ancient glacial area. It's the only such area in Hawaii, or indeed in the Pacific Islands, where you have an actual glacier that is under the surface, but is on the top of that mountain, in the form of a permanent frosted area. It is the tallest mountain in the Pacific and the site of our greatest prayers. So it is a place where our most important and most sacred prayers come from, where our ancestry all goes back to, where all people, we believe, are connected. And indeed, during this struggle, it has connected indigenous peoples all around the Pacific, as well as conscious peoples all around the world. And, it is a very, very important place in both spiritually and physically for humanity and for Kanaka Maoli. It is the tallest mountain of any Pacific island. It is the largest and the tallest mountain on Earth, although it is not the highest because it starts from the bottom of the ocean. But it is a massive, massive mountain that goes as deep as mountain roots can possibly go, to the very bed of the deepest ocean, all the way up into the heavens, at 13,000 plus feet. As well, I'd like to note that the Amamutsen of the Santa Cruz area, who've been a very, very strong ally in protecting Mauna Kea, are fighting their own struggle right now, where comment period is open for the next week to protect their sacred lands from a gravel mine. So please check them out. Basically, the indigenous peoples, the students, the conscious people, many conscious scientists, and others, we're building a much stronger consensus about what it means to protect sacred lands and why, and to hold up that indigenous leadership in land and water protection for the good of all people. So we're doing it in many different ways, and working especially to stop the lease from being renewed on Mauna Kea to the University of Hawaii. That lease expires in 2033, without which the TMT cannot be built. And we have similar leases that we are also fighting on the slopes of Mauna Kea to the US military for Pohakuloa Training Area and other places. So mahalo nui loa for asking. We stand with you, all of our indigenous brothers and sisters, on Indigenous Peoples Day. Our prayers go to and from Mauna Kea to all of you. We reach out to you there on Alcatraz, and we love you very much. Aloha.
Well, I thank you so much for this update. Keep us posted here on Flashpoints.
Mahalo.
Thank you. You just heard an interview with Laulani Teal about progress with protecting Mauna Kea. I'm Sarah Blanco for Flashpoints, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein.
Song and dance, hula and chants. We express our feelings to everyone that's listening. We be fighting, we be falling, we be singing. We must be as one. Stand up right. Must be. thinking we must be as one. Who we be fighting, who we be balling, who we be singing, we must be as one.
Where we start to be much better now. This time cannot come, only unite. As the children of our right, we must stand up for our cause. We must never give up without a fight. Stand firmly, my brothers and sisters, and we will not be stopped. Kuwa by our side as we stand planted. She provided knowledge and wisdom. What more do you want, Mona or Walker? You will be protected. Stand up and rise today. Nothing must be as one. Stand up and rise. Stand up, stand up, stand up.
We turn now to an extensive interview that I had with Kanahus Manuel, Indigenous activist, birth keeper. Kanahus has a message for Indigenous Peoples Day. And Kanahus is part of the Tiny House Warriors, and they're building houses on wheels to launch and deploy against the Trans Mountain Pipeline.
Hello, everybody. My name is Kanahus Manuel. I'm from the Sequatmoc and the Tanaka Nations in so-called British Columbia, Canada. We come from 180,000 square kilometers of unceded, unsurrendered territories. We've never signed treaties with Great Britain, Canada, nor British Columbia. And we want to remain that way, unceded territories forever. And we're fighting for our Indigenous rights and our title to our land. Our lands and our self-determination is the key words here, as Indigenous people around the world are fighting for this exact same thing, our land and self-determination. It's very easy to understand why we need land for our sustenance as Indigenous people, but also to build a new thriving economy that could actually be beneficial to the planet. So we think big, and right now we're building tiny houses on wheels to launch and deploy against the Trans Mountain Pipeline. It's a big, huge global project that is happening right now, mining bitumen from the Alberta tar sands, one of the biggest industrial projects known to mankind. You could see it from space, you could see it from Google Earth. Just look at Fort McMurray and zoom in, and you're going to see the amount of destruction needed in order to just get the bitumen out of the ground. This is the most dirtiest type of crude oil in the world, and the process to get it out is digging deep, deep into the tar sands and getting this bitumen. And they want to pump it from Edmonton Terminal all the way 1,152 kilometers from the Edmonton Terminal all the way to the Westridge Marine Terminal, which is around Vancouver, Burnaby, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, the territory, also an untreated nation. And that's all the inlets all around Vancouver, and you see those in the beautiful postcards and everything. That's what's at risk, is everything from the mountains all the way, the 1,000-kilometer pipeline, to the ocean, the Salish Sea. And this is very risky to our salmon, because they want to pump 890,000 barrels of that dirty diluted bitumen per day into super tankers, massive Aframax tankers that the inlets and the coast around Vancouver has never seen yet. And they want to increase the tankers to 400 tankers per year. And I was just recently went on a paddle around Vancouver Harbor and around the Tsleil-Waututh Nation and around those inlets. And there's just way too much activity already existing to accommodate any type of increase in any tanker traffic around there. The clam beds, the salmon, all the different types of seafood that you get from the ocean, from the sea right there, is at risk, including the salmon, which spends three of its years in the ocean, and then the other years navigating its way through the glacier rivers in the interior of so-called British Columbia to the spawning beds. And it is in my nation that has one of the largest sockeye salmon spawning grounds left in the world that we still continue to defend from mining and oil and gas infrastructure, you name it. And we're continuing to be bombarded by every form and every type of colonial industry and the infrastructure that they are establishing to steal more unceded resources from our land. And our battle has been directly on the ground, actually putting our tiny houses on wheels as Indigenous infrastructure to challenge the Crown and the colonial infrastructure and assume jurisdiction that they have over our land. And what we say when we erect our barricades and put up our blockades is that's where the conflict is. That's where we challenge the jurisdiction and it of the Crown and say, no more, not in here, not in these camps and these freedom resistance camps and these tiny house warrior villages. You don't have jurisdiction in here. And we've had our barricades up in a part of our territory, stopping and resisting against Trans Mountain Man Camp, which is an industrial worker camp to house hundreds and even 1,000 pipeline workers and contractors to build this pipeline. And these industrial worker camps are linked to increased violence against Indigenous women and girls, the increased sexual violence and the drug and alcohol violence that also comes from these camps. You're talking about 550 pipeline workers in one spot. They actually serve liquor in those camps, those industrial man camps. So it's just violence just waiting to erupt, and we've had to face the violence firsthand, myself and other Indigenous land defenders. Mind you, a lot of them are female. A lot of our land defenders are mothers because they know how crucial it is to, you know, stop this destruction, because the water, everything that our children and our future generations depend on. And for us as Indigenous people, it's always about the next seven generations. We're not just looking at, you know, our children, we're looking at our children's children's children for seven generations, and the impacts that we today have, or the amount of progress that we can build upon so we leave with our next generation with not such a big fight. And so it's always about training our young people up so they have the skills necessary to continue to resist colonization. I'm also an active birth keeper. I attend births, and I got into this work specifically to deliver my own babies. I have four children. My oldest is 20, and that's when I really started my birth work, around 21 years, when I became pregnant with my first child, and really knowing I didn't want to birth my baby in the hospital. There's just such a high C-section rate in the hospitals with native births, and I didn't want that to happen. I wanted to birth my babies into our nation the way that our ancestors did, you know, 1,000 years ago before colonization. And I did. I gave birth to my son in the mountains, and I sought out an elder to go isolate myself and deep in the mountains in the Marble Mountain Range in so-called British Columbia. And I birthed my baby with my twin sister and my mother by my side. And there's certain things that we do as mothers when we're raising our babies. And one of the things that we have, one of these beautiful ceremonies that we have, is our four food ceremony. And the baby doesn't touch anything to and taste anything else other than our traditional food. So the very first food is the mother's milk. And then once it's finally able to start introducing some type of solid food to the baby, we don't feed the baby pablum or like the rice cereals and things. That's not our traditional foods. It's what we would do is we feed them the four sacred foods, and we have four food chiefs. It's the berries, the roots, and the deer and the salmon. So we'll take a little bit of each of those and we'll put it in the baby's tongue, so when the baby tastes it, that's the very first thing that they'll ever taste in their memory, in their genetic memory, and that connects them to the land. that connects them to our chiefs, our four chief foods. And it connects them to our ceremonies, who we are as Native people, because our food is really important and crucial to who we are. It's a part of our culture. It's a part of our well-being, and it's kept us alive for all of this time. So we have teachings around our food. We don't throw our food away. We're very respectful for our food. And we come from extreme elements in BC. So we have the seasons. We have spring, summer, fall, and winter. And every week, every day, something is ripe. But if you're not collecting it, you're going to miss that window of opportunity to get that very crucial, important berry or that very crucial, important medicine during that window of opportunity to harvest it when it's ripe. And that's the way we moved on the land with great care. They said we walked with moccasins because you walk with sneakers and you're walking over rocks and you're walking sloppy on the earth. When you walk with moccasins, you can't walk like that. You have to walk close to the earth. You got to watch your footstep, be mindful of where you step, and watch the little critters, watch the little the rocks, the sticks, and everything. You have to be very tread lightly and be very mindful of the earth. And that's some of the other teachings you get taught in the womanhood ceremonies. You know, they have to wear only moccasins, and different teachings that are very crucial. They may seem like not very important teachings, but it links you to a bigger understanding and a relationship that you have with the rest of creation and our planet. And so those are important. And that's why birth and taking our birth into our own hands is very important. And it connects us so deeply. They say our roots go so deep, they go to creation. That's what we're connecting with our babies and these teachings and the birth and connecting with other women. And the food, if we're not mindful, like we have those ceremonies to remind us. And now with climate change, those windows of time to harvest our food and our medicines and our salmon are changing, because climate change is changing that, where they said, oh, when the Saskatoon berries are ready, you know that this fish is ready to fish. But then extremes of heat and then frost are sometimes killing our berries off, so we don't even have any berries one year because of the extreme climate change and the temperatures, and where Indigenous people are starting to feel the wrath, and we're starting to be like some of the first climate refugees as Indigenous people, because we're feeling the impacts first, because we're so connected to the land and dependent on the land for our foods. So we feel it the first. And we need to change that. We need to, you know, address these issues, because it's going to drastically affect Indigenous people and our way of life.
Is there anything that you ask, one thing that you feel that we can do, whether it's politically, physically, and body, spirit, anything that we can do?
Yeah, I feel that as Indigenous people, we always hear of the chiefs and the matriarchs and the leaders, but we need more warriors. We need more moccasins on the ground. We need more warriors that are actually able to take direct action, because what we're doing when we confront industry and big global projects like that is we are creating risk and uncertainty. Those are financial terms, risk and uncertainty to their projects. We know that the only way that we're going to get the colonial governments to even listen to Indigenous people or change any land policies or laws regarding us as Indigenous people having access and to it is that we have to confront them. We got to hit them where it hurts, and we know where it hurts. It hurts in their wallet. It hurts with their money. And so when they have big projects like this, they're dependent on international banks. They're dependent on international insurance companies to insure and underwrite these projects, to even get funding, to even put them on the ground, to even hire employees. They need insurance. And so we've been, you know, taking the lead from my father, Arthur Manuel. He's passed on now, but we still have his organization active, Indigenous Network on Economies and Trade, where we've been traveling to Europe to brief the banks and insurance companies about the risks and uncertainty in investing and doing business with Canada or on so-called Canadian soil, which is Indigenous land, contested Indigenous land. And so we work with international lawyers, PhD economists, and a really heavy caliber, high caliber team to craft these risk briefs that we travel over to Europe with. And we're going to be doing another tour later on in this year to even further cite more risks, because we're working with this amazing team to actually quantify and actually put a dollar price tag of what Indigenous resistance is costing them on the ground. We've successful in shutting down Canada, shutting down all the transportation corridors that run the whole economic infrastructure for Canada, was the transportation corridors. And along with other Indigenous frontline movements, we were successful in calling on a nationwide shutdown of Canada's transportation corridors to show that we have the power to do it and to show the type of risk and uncertainty that they will face if they continue to push fossil fuel pipelines through our territories.
And then, and while you're doing all of this, which is powerful, of course, tell us a little bit about how your organization is able or not able to work with Trudeau, but also Parliament and so-called Indigenous leaders who have historically represented Indigenous people but may not be Indigenous themselves.
Okay, well, the Canadian government is a thieving country. It's living and it's based its whole economics off of the stolen native lands and resources, and it's become a very wealthy superpower because of it. And what we say is that Canada is illegally occupying our territories, that the occupation of our lands is an act of war on us as Indigenous people, because there's no land agreement set aside for them to even be on our territory. And Trudeau, you know, Canada is just like 155 years old. It's a baby country. And, you know, Justin Trudeau, we call Justin Trudeau Baby Trudeau because his father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, faced off with my grandfather, Grand Chief George Manuel, back in the day, because Pierre Elliott Trudeau was pushing the white paper policy, which was a racist policy, a white supremacist policy, to exterminate Indigenous people out of any type of existence or land in Canada. And grant us Canadian status like any other Canadian and own fee simple title that we would eventually have to pay tax on. And Native people rallied across the country, called the Constitution Express, where they took a train across Canada to Ottawa. Tens of thousands of Native people rallied in Ottawa to get Section 35(1) in the Constitution. At the time, they were trying to repatriate the Constitution, Canada. And so we fought, we got 35(1) into the Constitution that says Aboriginal title and rights exist in this country. Constitutional talks failed after that. It was supposed to happen to more clarify and determine what does Aboriginal title and rights mean. It failed. It went now to many different Supreme Court cases, title cases, to more determine what does title mean? What does Aboriginal title mean? We know we have a right to pick our berries, but do we have a right to the land that the berries are on? And that's what we're saying. We do have a right to that title. And so Canada tried every which way to co-opt any type of Native organizing that took place. And since then, when my grandfather George Manuel was alive, he helped form the National Indian Brotherhood, and which now became the Assembly of First Nations. And those Assembly of First Nations are what they call, they have a national chief and they have all these chiefs which are under the INAC system, which is the Indian Act federal system, invented by the federal government, still funded by the federal government. They're called the Indian Act system, and that's where they put a process in place for band members to elect a chief and council system, still under the federal system. Pretty well the feds, they invented a system, a fed system, and they call it the chief and council system. So it's really confusing for natives and states and things when they hear chief and council. They think that's the true leadership of the grassroots people on the ground, but it's not. It's a federal system that was invented to continue to keep native people in the Indian reserves, you know, corral them into the Indian reserves so they could have a free-for-all for the resource extraction on our territories. And so the Assembly of First Nations, that federal organization in Canada, does not represent the grassroots people. In fact, the grassroots people have rights that are collective rights over and beyond. The Federal Indian Band Chief and Council, they don't hold Aboriginal title. They don't have those rights because they're federal system. It is the grassroots people that hold the title and the rights collectively. So, for example, in Suquamish territory, we have around 10,000 Suquamish. And so every man, woman, child, berry picker, hunter, fisherman have a right, just as every other person next to them has that collective right. We can't sell that right or title away to the government because, you know, that family right there uses it and that family right there uses it. So when the government and corporations move to get free, prior, informed consent from Indigenous people, who do they go to? And that's the big issue. The federal government and the corporation will lead them to this federally invented chief and council system to get consent for projects, which is wrong because that's a federally imposed system on our people. And we've never, some nations have continued to live out their traditional governance and their decision-making process. Some nations have been totally impacted by colonization and are reviving their governance system and decision-making process. But one of the things you see, like with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, is that Indigenous people from around the world, real live organizers, worked hard, including my grandfather's time, to go through the terminology and the wording. And, you know, we have rights. We have rights to our own decision-making process. We have a right to our own leadership. And that's where we're at as Indigenous people, standing up to organize ourselves in massive assemblies in our nation to revive our governance structure because just the how colonization has, you know, attacked so hard against it by putting this other system in place that's not our traditional system. It's a very confusing way, but the government, you know, made it by design to be like that. But really, I want to say that this is a global fight, this fight against the fossil fuel industry, and it is a global fight. That's the reason why I'm coming south of the medicine line, south, meaning into the so-called United States, to work and organize with Indigenous communities and movements to organize a bigger global fight against fossil fuel and the tanker traffic that will soon to embark and contaminate the coast, you know, the West Coast, all the way from Vancouver through those inlets all the way to the Washington State coast, Oregon coast, and the California coast, and really impacting the fishing communities that are still dependent on it. So this is our big drive right now, is to organize. We are building, in a few weeks, we'll be building a 24-foot tiny house warriors feast house commercial kitchen. And this will allow us to travel to the Indigenous communities to feast with them and talk about the very important, crucial issues that we are facing today with the tanker traffic and the increase of just all of the fossil fuel tankers and out in the ocean, all the way down to the oil refineries in Richmond, California. So this is connecting the dots of a lot of movements, and we want to network with all of the movements that have been doing this work throughout all of the decades. We've connected with Indigenous people and Lummi, you know, Lower Elwha, Tulalip, Nisqually, Puyallup, Muckleshoot, and the list is going to continue to go on, and we are going to be, you know, a force to be reckon with here on the coast. And I'm just honored to be a part of these circles, and I'm making my way in the spirit of my grandfather, late grandfather, Dr. Grand Chief George Manuel, and how he founded the World Council of Indigenous People to unite us all. And so in that spirit, I'm doing this work to unite our Indigenous people and making my way to this very important ceremony in Alcatraz to stand with my sister, Morning Star Gali, in prayer, and with all the Indigenous people throughout North America, and join our prayer for this day. We're facing so much, and including, you know, the police violence that we all face as Indigenous land defenders. Up in North, it's the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They made a new division called the Community Industry Response Group that specifically just the battle against Conahus and Tiny House Warriors and the Wet'suwet'en and Land Defenders and all the people fighting against the pipelines, the Native people. They formed a brand new division in the RCMP, which I actually have a lawsuit because they broke my wrist on a wrongful arrest. And so we're still facing off with the RCMP. It's like who the Canadian government will put off to face off with the Indigenous land versus Crown land, and as we assert our rights to our land, and you know, as we move here south of Medicine Line to work with Indigenous communities, that same, the same sovereignty over land is the same sovereignty over the ocean. These are big international talks when you start to talk about Indigenous people having jurisdiction over these waters that these international colonial states try to claim. So it's going to be a big fight, and a lot of conversation is going to come out from this battle against the tankers. But really, we want to, you know, stop the amounts of tankers out there on the coast and link it to the Alberta tar sands and why the Alberta tar sands just needs to be completely shut down. And, you know, it's, they're announcing, you know, these Indigenous People Day. And really, I want to connect with the Indigenous peoples from around the world that has marked that day, Colonization Day, called by the Indigenous people in Bolivia and the Alaska Natives, all the way down to the Mapuche down in Chile, will be marking that day with prayers and intention, all of North America to be decolonized. And so I'm joining the prayers for that day on October 10th, when we're going to be at the sunrise ceremony there in Alcatraz. Join our prayers and our intentions with Indigenous peoples throughout North America and around the world, you know, to mark this day also as Decolonization Day. My name is Conahus Manuel. I'm from the Sequatmokan Tanaka Nations in so-called British Columbia, Canada. I'm with the Tiny House Warriors and the Sequatmok Women Warriors Society.
I want to thank you so much for joining me and joining all of our listeners at KPFA. Safe travels. Bye for now.
Thank you.
In the Red River, in the Red River, in the Red, 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 we
For Flashpoints, I have been your host, Sarah Blanco, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. Thank you for joining us on Indigenous Peoples Day. Thank you to Dennis Bernstein and Gavilan Molina. Thank you also to all of my guests. And thanks to my advisors, Frank Sterling and Morningstar Galley. Shout out also to Catherine Bocknight. And a shout out to the Radio Free Alcatraz crew.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara Lamorticella, and Walt Curtis.